We're back again with another episode of Did You Know? This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. This is Pam Vesper welcoming you to today's show.
And this is Bob Martin telling you, I almost didn't make it to today's show.
What happened, Bob? Did you get stuck in traffic? It can get pretty nasty on the freeway sometimes.
Oh, I didn't even get out of the house.
Oh, let me guess. You started to get out on the wrong side of bed, and you couldn't figure out where the wall came from.
No, that was last week. I painted a sign on the wall now that says, do not exit.
Bob, you did not.
Don't laugh now. Reminders like that can save a lot of trouble.
Oh, such as what?
Well, such as I put a label in my socks that says TIF.
TIF?
Yeah. Toes in first.
Bob, just tell me why you almost didn't make it to the studio.
Well, you see, I was having breakfast and...
Don't tell us the orange juice said concentrate, so you did.
Is that what it means? I thought it had something to do with the juice. I'll concentrate tomorrow.
Now see what you started.
No, it wasn't the orange juice. I was having a bowl of Rice Krispies. And I know this is going to sound weird, but it went snap and crackle, but it never went pop.
Why don't you and the orange juice concentrate on that tomorrow?
The following is a bit we ran out of time for 2 weeks ago, but it's well worth the wait. Did you know that one of America's greatest musicians might not have made it to the center of the stage if it had not been for a childhood brush with the law? This is the story of Louis Armstrong. Louis was born in a rough section of New Orleans called the Battlefield on August 4, 1901. The area was filled with dance halls and honky-tonks and brothels, and out of all them, music was constantly streaming. And then add to that the music of the many outdoor funerals that were typical of this section of New Orleans. And this wasn't sad music. This was emotion-stirring and foot-stirring music. By the time Louis was 6 years old, he had joined three other boys who were singing on street corners for tips. He saved from his meager earnings and eventually bought himself a second-hand cornet from a pawn shop and taught himself to play.
In 1913, his world changed forever. It was New Year's Eve, and the whole world was celebrating. At least that was what it seemed like in the battlefield. Louis joined the festivities by firing a gun into the air.
Did he hit anyone?
No mention is made of that, but he was seen by the police, who arrested him. He was sent to reform school. In the end, this was probably a good thing for young Armstrong. He met a man named Peter Davis, who was head of the school's music program. Mr. Davis gave Louis a bugle, gave him his first formal music instruction, and put him into the band, eventually making him the group's leader.
He's lucky they hadn't cut music programs for lack of money.
What?
Well, that's what's happening. Schools run short of money, and they start by cutting art and music things because they're not important.
Bob, this is reform school.
They don't get short of money? Without music, I don't think Louis Armstrong would have become famous for making license plates.
All right. Pam, go on.
Right. When Louis got out of reform school at age 13, he got a job delivering coal and newspapers to help make money for his family, but his newly acquired musical talents started to pay dividends. He hung around a band named Kid Ory's, which featured one of the city's best cornet players, Joe Oliver. And a few years later, when Oliver left to go to Chicago, Armstrong took his place in the band.
Louis was good. So good, in fact, that in 1922, Joe Oliver called from Chicago and offered Louis a job making an unbelievable $52 a week. Louis was off to Chicago, where he was now a member of the Creole Jazz Band. Joe Oliver used to sponsor what were called cutting contests, where local horn players would try to outblow each other. Armstrong outblew everybody.
By 1924, Fletcher Henderson from Harlem offered Armstrong a job. So he upgraded from the cornet to the trumpet and was off to New York. But Louis also wanted to sing. So one night at an amateur night competition, he put on a show-stopping performance, playing and singing, Everybody Loves My Baby, But My Baby Don't Love Nobody But Me. First place, and from then on, he got to sing and play for Fletcher Henderson.
There were two reasons why Armstrong wanted to sing. First, his style was hard on his cheeks. His cheek-puffed-out style had earned him a nickname of Satchel Mouth. And second, he could earn more money as a singer.
By 1925, he found his way back to Chicago, and there joined a studio band for OK Records. That band had Armstrong on trumpet, his wife Lil on the piano, Kid Ory on trombone, Johnny Dobbs on clarinet, and Johnny St. Cyr on banjo. At one session, they recorded a piece called Heebie Jeebies, and here's a did you know for that. It is the first recording that was made using scat singing, Armstrong specially, something he'd picked up as a kid in New Orleans.
By the mid-40s, the swing era was winding down, and the era of big bands was almost over. Seeing the writing on the wall, Armstrong scaled down to a smaller six-piece combo, the All-Stars. Personnel would frequently change, but this would be the group Armstrong would perform live with until the end of his career. Members of the group, at one time or another, included Jack Teagarden, Earl Fatha Hines, Sid Catlett, Barney Bigard, Trummy Young, Edmund Hall, Billy Kyle, Tyree Glenn, and many other jazz legends. Armstrong continued recording for Decca in the late 1940s and early 50s, creating a string of popular hits including Blueberry Hill, That Lucky Old Sun, La Vie en Rose, A Kiss to Build a Dream On, and I Get Ideas. Armstrong joined with Columbia Records in the mid-50s and soon cut some of the finest albums of his career for producer George Avakian, including Louis Armstrong Plays W.C. Handy and Satch Plays Fats. It was also for Columbia that Armstrong scored one of the biggest hits of his career, the jazz transformation of Kurt Weill's Mack the Knife.
During this period, Armstrong set a number of African-American firsts. In 1936, he became the first African-American jazz musician to write an autobiography, Swing That Music. That same year, he became the first African-American to get featured billing in a major Hollywood movie with his turn in Pennies from Heaven, starring Bing Crosby. Additionally, he became the first African-American entertainer to host a nationally sponsored radio show in 1937 when he took over Rudy Valley's Fleischman's Yeast Show for 12 weeks. Armstrong continued to appear in major films with the likes of Mae West, Martha Raye, and Dick Powell. He was also a frequent presence on radio and often broke box office records at the height of what is now known as the swing era. Some of the finest recordings of his career included Swing That Music, Jubilee, and Strutting with Some Barbecue.
During the post-war era, when big band and jazz began to fall out of style, Armstrong remained popular. The United States even sent him to foreign countries as a kind of goodwill ambassador. Once in England, a reporter referred to him as Satchmo, a distorted version of Satchel Mouth, and the name stuck.
And did you know that on one of his goodwill ambassadorial-style trips, one foreign country accused him of attempted espionage? They didn't understand scat singing, so they didn't know what he was saying and thought it was some kind of code to the underground.
He performed all over the world in the 1950s and 60s, including throughout Europe, Africa, and Asia. Legendary CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow followed Armstrong with a camera crew on some of his worldwide excursions, turning the resulting footage into a theatrical documentary, Satchmo the Great, released in 1957. Though his popularity was hitting new highs in the 1950s, and despite breaking down so many barriers for his race and being a hero to the African-American community for so many years, Armstrong began losing his standing with two segments of his audience, modern jazz fans and young African-Americans. Bebop, a new form of jazz, had blossomed in the 1940s, featuring young geniuses such as Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, and Miles Davis. The younger generation of musicians saw themselves as artists, not as entertainers. They saw Armstrong's stage persona and his music as old-fashioned, and criticized him in the press. Armstrong fought back, but for many young jazz fans, he was regarded as an out-of-date performer with his best days behind him.
The struggle for civil rights was growing tenser with each passing year, with more protests, marches, and speeches from African Americans wanting equal rights. To any young jazz listeners at the time, Armstrong's ever-smiling demeanor seemed like it was from a bygone era. And the trumpeter's refusal to comment on politics for many years only furthered perceptions that he was out of touch. These views changed in 1957 when Armstrong saw the Little Rock Central High School integration crisis on television. Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus sent in the National Guard to prevent 9 African-American students from entering the school. When Armstrong saw this, as well as white protesters hurling invective at the students, he blew his top to the press, telling a reporter that President Dwight D. Eisenhower had no guts for letting Faubus run the country. And he further stated, "The way they are treating my people in the South, the government can go to hell." Armstrong's words made front-page news around the world. Though he had finally spoken out after years of remaining publicly silent, he received criticism at the time from both black and white public figures. Not a single jazz musician who had previously criticized him took his side. Today, this is seen as one of the bravest, most definitive moments in Armstrong's life.
In the 1960s, he made 2 of his most famous songs, "Hello, Dolly," and "It's a Wonderful World." Satchmo continued playing until the day before he died. In July of 1971, he performed at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, and the next night suffered a heart attack. One of our country's great musicians and representatives.
And on a lighter note, did you know that when Louis Armstrong made the film High Society with Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra, right after the opening number, when Armstrong and his band arrive at Crosby's mansion, the butler invites Louis in by calling him Mr. Satchel Mouth, an inside joke.
Okay, you promised me another quiz, and I've been waiting all week.
Don't worry, Pam, I've got it right here, but I have to warn you.
Yes?
Well,
according to the instructions, this is a quiz meant for smart people, right, Kurt?
Definitely smart people.
Are you implying that I won't be able to answer it?
Arr.
Them is fighting words, boys. I'll do a gig on a dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum, throw a Moses Law again, a pair of you. Keel-haul you both, throw you top of mainsail, strip the barnacles from your mizzen, and make you walk the plank before you can get another R out.
Whoa, where did you learn that?
I found this great home study course, How to Speak R in 10 Easy Lessons.
Will
it's like
hurt?
Piracy for dummies.
Will that hurt?
I don't know. I've only gotten to lesson 3.
Then, quick. Give her the quiz.
Okay, Pam, here we go.
Care for a drink, Pam? I have an old, old bottle of 7-Up.
Don't need it, guys. Let's go.
Okay. If I went to bed one night at 8 o'clock and I wound up the alarm to go off at 9 the next morning, how much sleep would I get?
Well, let me see. 8 at night till 9 the next morning, that's 13 hours.
Wrong, Bob. He said it was a wind-up clock, 1 hour.
1 hour?
That's right. A wind-up clock can't tell between a.m. and p.m., so 8 to 9 is 1 hour.
One for the pirate captain. Okay, my turn. Why can't a man living in North Carolina be buried in South Carolina?
Permission to speak, Captain.
Belay the pirates for a bit, matey. What's the answer?
Well, there's no reason at all, as soon as he's dead. Until then, he couldn't even do it in Kentucky. Okay, try this one. 2 men are playing checkers. Each man has won the same number of games, and there are no draws. How could this be?
Let's see. This could only happen if they were not playing each other.
Good for you.
All right, careful. This one is a stumper. If you had only one match, and you entered a room in which there was a kerosene lamp, an oil heater, and a wood-burning stove, which one would you light first?
Since the kerosene lamp would probably be the easiest to light, that would be my first choice.
But the wood would burn the longest and give you the most time to get the others lit.
But on the other hand, if you lit the oil first...
Let me save you some time. I'd light the match first.
Oh, that was pretty sneaky. If that's the kind of questions you're asking, how about this? You have 2 ordinary U.S. coins in your hand. Together, they add up to 55 cents. One of them is not a nickel. What are they?
2 coins, and one is not a nickel. Impossible.
No, you're holding a half dollar and a nickel.
Oh, but she said one is not a nickel.
Yes, one isn't, but the other is.
Hey. I bought a new word processor that's small enough to fit in my pocket. It can add, subtract, and is capable of doing calculations in every language in the world, yet it needs no electricity.
Well, how many batteries does it need?
And it must be expensive.
No, none. None and no. It only cost a few cents, and I've seen a lot of places that give them away free.
What? For free?
Sure, it's called a pencil, and the eraser was only used once by Beethoven.
Oh, boo, all right. A man married 48 women. None of them died, and none were divorced. Yet he is one of the most respected men in the community. How come?
A woman could have done it, too.
A woman?
Of course. She was a member of the clergy, and she's going to make it 49 next week. Last one. If a farmer has 5 haystacks in one field and 4 haystacks in another field, how many haystacks would he have if he combined them all in the center field?
One.
That's right. If he combined them all, he'd only have one big stack.
Okay, all right. This next one is going to take you some time.
Wait a minute. You said that was the last one.
I was quoted out of context. John is asleep on the couch, and Mary is dead on the floor. Around Mary is a puddle of water and some broken glass. There's no one else in the house, and all the doors and windows are locked. How did this happen? Think about it while we hear this story by O. Henry.
Lost on Dress Parade by O. Henry. Mr. Towers Chandler was pressing his evening suit in his hall bedroom. One iron was heating on a small gas stove, the other was being pushed vigorously back and forth to make the desirable crease that would be seen later on extending a straight line from Mr. Chandler's patent leather shoes to the edge of his low-cut vest. So much of the hero's toilet must be entrusted to our confidence. The remainder may be guessed at by those genteel poverty has driven to ignoble expedient. Our next view of him shall be as he descends the steps of his lodging house, immaculately and correctly clothed, calm, assured, handsome, in the appearance of typical New York young clubman setting out, slightly bored, to inaugurate the pleasures of the evening. Chandler's honorarium was $18 per week. He was employed in the office of an architect. He was 22 years old. He considered architecture to be truly an art, and he honestly believed, though he would not have dared to admit it in New York, that the Flatiron Building was inferior design to the great cathedral in Milan. Out of each week's earning, Chandler set aside $1. At the end of each 10 weeks, with the extra capital thus accumulated, he purchased one gentleman's evening from the bargain counter of stingy old Father Time. He arrayed himself in the regalia of millionaires and presidents. He took himself to the quarter where life was brightest and showiest, and there he dined with taste and luxury. With $10, a man may, for a few hours, play the wealthy idler to perfection. The sum is ample for a well-considered meal, a bottle bearing a respectable label, commensurate tips, a smoke, cab fare, and the ordinary et cetera's. This one delectable evening, culled from each dull 70, was to Chandler a source of renascent bliss. To the society bud comes but one debut. It stands alone sweet in her memory when her hair has whitened, but to Chandler each 10 weeks brought a joy as keen, as thrilling, as new as the first one had been. To sit among the bon vivants, under palms in the swirl of concealed music, to look upon the habitués of such a paradise, and to be looked upon by them. What is a girl's first dance in short-sleeved toll compared to this? Up Broadway, Chandler moved with the Vespertine dress parade. For this evening he was to exhibit as well as a gaze. For the next 69 evenings he would be dining in Cheviot and worsted at dubious table d'hote at whirlwind lunch counters on sandwiches and beer in his hall bedroom. He was willing to do that, for he was a true son of this great sizzle city of razzle-dazzle, and to him one evening in the limelight made up for many dark ones. Chandler protracted his walk until the 40s began to intersect with the great and glittering Primrose Way, for the evening was yet young, and when one is of the beau monde, Only one day in 70, one loves to protract the pleasure. Eyes bright, sinister, curious, admiring, provocative, alluring, were bent upon him, for his garb and air proclaimed him a devotee to the hour of solace and pleasure. At a certain corner, he came to a standstill, proposing to himself the question of turning back toward the showy and fashionable restaurant in which he usually dined on the evenings of his special luxury. Just then, a girl scudded right around the corner, slipped on a patch of an icy snow, and fell plump upon the sidewalk. Chandler assisted her to her feet with instant and solicitous courtesy. The girl hobbled to the wall of the building, leans against it, and thanked him demurely. "I think my ankle is strained," she said. "I twisted it when I fell." "Does it pain you much?" inquired Chandler. "Only when I rest my weight upon it. I think I'll be able to walk in a minute or two." "If I can be of any further service," suggested the young man, "I will call a cab or..." "Oh, thank you," said the girl, "but I am sure you need not trouble yourself any further. It was so awkward of me, and my shoe heels are horribly common sense. I can't blame them at all." Chandler looked at the girl and found her swiftly drawing her interest. She was pretty in a refined way, and her eye was both merry and kind. She was inexpensively clothed in a plain black dress that suggested a sort of uniform such as shop girls wear. Her glossy black hair showed in coils around a cheap hat of black straw, whose only ornament was a velvet ribbon bow. She could have posed as a model for one of the self-respecting working girls of the best type. A sudden idea came into his head of the young architect. He would ask this girl to dine with him. There was the element that his splendid but solitary periodic feats had lacked. His brief season of elegant luxury would be doubly enjoyed if he could add to it a lady's society. This girl was a lady. He was sure her manner and speech settled that, and in spite of her extremely plain attire, he felt that he would be pleased to sit at table with her. These thoughts passed swiftly through his mind, and he decided to ask her. It was a breach of etiquette, of course, but oftentimes wage-earning girls waive formalities in matters of this kind. They were generally shrewd judges of men and thought better of their own judgment than they did of useless conventions. His $10, discreetly expended, would enable the two of them to dine very well indeed. The dinner would no doubt be a wonderful experience thrown into a routine of the girl's life, and her lively appreciation of it would add to his own triumph and pleasure. "I think," he said to her with frank gravity, "that your foot needs a longer rest than you suppose. Now I'm going to suggest in a way in which you can give it at that, and at the same time do me a favor. I was on my way to dine all by my lonely self when you came tumbling around the corner. You come with me, and we'll have a cozy dinner and a pleasant talk together, and by that time your game ankle will be able to carry you home very nicely." The girl looked quickly up into Chandler's clear, pleasant countenance. Her eyes twinkled very brightly, and then she smiled ingenuously. "But we don't know each other. It wouldn't be right, would it?" "There's nothing wrong about it," said the young man candidly. "I'll introduce myself. Permit me. Mr. Towers Chandler. After our dinner, which I will try to make as pleasant as possible, I will bid you good evening or attend you safely to your door, whichever you prefer." "But dear me," said the girl, with a glance at Chandler's faultless attire, "in this old dress and hat." "Never mind that," said Chandler cheerfully. "I'm sure you look more charming in them than anyone we will see in the most elaborate dinner toilette." "My ankle does hurt yet," admitted the girl, attempting a limping step. "I think I will accept your invitation, Mr. Chandler. You may call me Miss Marion." "Come then, Miss Marion," said the younger tech gaily, but with perfect courtesy. "You will not have to walk far. There is a respectable and a good restaurant in the next block. You will have to lean on my arm, so walk slowly. It is a lonely dining all by myself, and I'm just a little bit glad that you slipped on the ice." When the two were established at the well-appointed table with a promising waiter hovering in attendance, Chandler began to experience the real joy that his regular outing always brought to him. The restaurant was not so showy or pretentious as the one farther down Broadway, which he had always preferred, but it was nearly so. The tables were filled with prosperous-looking diners. There was good orchestra, playing softly enough to make conversation a possible pleasure, and the cuisine and service were beyond criticism. His companion, even in her cheap hat and dress, held herself with an air that added distinction to the natural beauty of her face and figure. And it is certain that she looked at Chandler with his animated but self-possessed manner and his self-kindling and frank blue eyes with something not far from admiration. Then it was that the madness of Manhattan, the frenzy of fuss and feathers, the bestialness of brag, the provincial plague of pose, seized upon Towers Chandler. He was on Broadway, surrounded by pomp and style, and there were eyes to look upon him. On the stage of that comedy, he assumed to play the one-night part of a butterfly of fashion and an idler of means and taste. He was dressed for the part, and all his good angels had not the power to prevent him from acting it. So he began to prate to Miss Marion of clubs, of teas, of golfing, riding, and kennels, and cotillions, and tours abroad, and threw out hints of a yacht lying at the Larchmont. He could see that she was vastly impressed by this vague talk, so he endorsed his pose by random insinuation concerning great wealth, and mentioned familiarly a few names that were handled reverently by the proletariat. It was Chandler's sort of little day, and he was wringing from it the best that he could, as he saw it. And yet once or twice he saw the pure gold of this girl shine through the mist that his egotism had raised between him and all objects. "This way of living that you speak of," she said, "sounds so futile and purposeless. Haven't you any work to do in the world that might interest you more?" "My dear Miss Marion," he exclaimed, "work? Think of dressing every day for dinner, of making half a dozen calls in an afternoon, with a policeman at every corner ready to jump into your auto and take you to the station if you get up any greater speed than a donkey cart's gait. We do-nothings are the hardest workers in the world." The dinner was concluded, the waiter generously fed, and the two walked out to the corner where they had met. Miss Marion walked very well now. Her limp was scarcely noticeable. "Thank you for a nice time," she said frankly. "I must run home now. I liked the dinner very much, Mr. Chandler." He shook hands with her, smiling cordially, and said something about a game of bridge at his club. He watched her for a moment, walking rather rapidly eastward. Then he found a cab to drive him slowly homeward. In the chilly bedroom, Chandler laid away his evening clothes for 69 days' rest. He went about it thoughtfully. "That was a stunning girl," he said to himself. "She was right, too. I'd be sworn, even if she does have to work. Perhaps if I told her the truth, instead of all that razzle-dazzle, we might... Now, confound it. I had a play up to the close." Thus spoke the brave one who was born and reared in the wigwams of the tribe of the Manhattans. The girl, after leaving her entertainer, sped swiftly across town until she arrived at a handsome, sedate mansion 2 squares to the east, facing that on the avenue which is the highway of Mammon and the auxiliary gods. Here she entered hurriedly and ascended to a room where a handsome young lady in elaborate house dress looked anxiously out the window. "Oh, you madcap!" exclaimed the elder girl, when the other entered. "When will you quit frightening us this way? It was 2 hours since you ran out in that rag of an old dress and Marie's hat. Mama's been so alarmed, she sent Louis in the auto to try and find you. You are a bad, thoughtless person." The elder girl touched a button, and the maid came in a moment. "Marie, tell Mama that Miss Marion has returned." "Don't scold, sister. I only ran down to Mademoiselle Theo's to tell her to use mauve insertion instead of pink. My costume and Marie's hat were just what I needed. Everyone thought I was a shop girl, I am sure." "Dinner's over, dear. You stayed so late." "I know. I slipped on the sidewalk and turned my ankle. I couldn't walk, so I hobbled into a restaurant and sat there until I was better. Now, that is why I was so long." The two girls sat in the window seat, looking out at the lights and the stream of hurrying vehicles in the avenue. The younger one cuddled down with her head in her sister's lap. "We will have to marry some day," she said dreamily, "both of us. We have so much money that we will not be allowed to disappoint the public. Do you want me to tell you the kind of man I could love, sis?" "Go on, you scatterbrain," smiled the other. "I could love a man with dark and kind of blue eyes, who is gentle and respectful to poor girls, who is handsome and good and does not try to flirt. but I could love him only if he had an ambition, an object, some work to do in the world. I would not care how poor he was. I could help build him in his way up. But, sister dear, the kind of man we always meet, the man who lives an idle life between society and his clubs, I could not love a man like that, even if his eyes were blue and he were so kind to poor girls we met on the street. I got it. Somebody crawled in the window.
The window was locked.
Well, they crawled in the window and then left by the door.
The door was locked.
Well, he locked the door on the way out.
Why would he kill Mary and then take the time to lock the door on the way out?
He didn't want anybody to know the horse was stolen.
What horse?
Well, the one that was in the barn before it was stolen, where they would have locked the barn door if it hadn't been stolen. But now, since it was, they didn't have to. But he did anyway because he didn't want anybody to know that it was. Or wasn't.
What has this got to do with John and Mary?
I don't know.
Keep thinking.
Meanwhile, did you know that Charles Lindbergh was Time Magazine's first Man of the Year, 1927?
Did you know that Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, had part of his ashes taken into outer space? It was April 21st, 1997, aboard a Pegasus XL rocket, along with the ashes from 20 other people.
Did you know that one of those other 20 was Timothy Leary? Now that's what I call getting high.
Okay, did you know that Jack Kelly, father of actress and princess Grace Kelly, won 3 Olympic gold medals in rowing in the 1920 and 1924 Olympics?
Did you know that, despite Mel Brooks' line in The History of the World Part 1, it's great to be king? It often isn't. In 1774, Louis XVI became king of France. Now, he was book smart, but not politically adept, and he found the two previous monarchs had all but depleted the royal treasury. By 1788, half of Paris was out of work and inflation was rampant, and he married Marie Antoinette. And what was so bad about her? Mostly, she was an Austrian at the time when the French didn't particularly like foreigners.
In 1793, the National Convention voted 387 to 334, I bet you always thought it was a landslide, to convict him of the charged crimes against the people of France. You can read here of being a weak king at the wrong time. His last words were, "I pray to God that the blood you are going to shed may never be visited on France." Well, once they got the guillotine going, they didn't know where to stop.
Then there was King Edward II. Did you know that the Earl of Cornwall was not only Edward's favorite advisor, he was also Edward's favorite companion at a time when that sort of thing was frowned upon? If the Earl had been more discreet, things might have been left to pass. But the Earl wasn't, and pushed his authority and position in the faces of the other nobles. So finally, in 1311, the barons got together and passed the Ordinances, which curtailed Edward's power and exiled Cornwall. But a few months later, he was back in court, so it was off with his head.
This greatly upset Edward, who learned to play the political game better and started to play the nobles off each other and killed a few of them along the way. By 1322, Edward revoked the ordinances, but things started to go terribly wrong between he and his wife, Isabella. By 1325, Isabella took up with one of Edward's enemies, Roger Mortimer. Edward had him imprisoned, but he escaped and fled to France. In 1326, Isabella joined Roger, and together they invaded England, overthrew Edward, and tossed him into prison. He died in prison, according to legend, from a thrust of a red-hot poker.
And then there was Tsar Nicholas II. Did you know that things started out badly for Nicholas when, at his coronation in 1896, the crowds rioted when people began to think that presents being handed out would all be foregone before they got any? He turned out to be a fairly inept ruler and was pretty much to blame for getting the country involved in a disastrous war with Japan in 1904, which led to the revolt in 1905.
Now, bad decisions continued to plague Nicholas, leading to a disastrous loss of Russian soldiers during World War I. Food shortages and economic depression led to the revolts of 1917. Nicholas and his family were detained in Siberia in Yekaterinburg, and in July of 1918, the family was executed, According to recent DNA tests on bones found at the scene, this included Anastasia.
Our last poor king is Tut. Did you know he became pharaoh at age 9 in 1347 BCE? His advisors mostly ruled the country, ordering that the programs of monotheism were undone and the country returned to the old religions of the many gods. When he reached the age of 18, apparently he wanted to assert himself somewhat. Before he could do any real damage, something happened to him. What that was has been subject of debate for years. It was first thought he was poisoned. Then a hole in the back of his skull seemed to indicate somebody had plunked him. Most recent medical tests point to the fact that he was an extremely frail lad with a cleft palate and a broken leg and malarial infection. The problems could have been congenital since his parents were brother and sister. And the hole in his head? They expect that came from the embalming process. But one thing appears, and that is that one of Tut's advisors, A.Y., married his widow and became pharaoh himself.
That's it. A plunk on the head. Mary was having a glass of water, and John came up behind her and plunked her on the head. When she fell, she dropped the glass, which broke and spilled the water.
John didn't kill Mary.
You mean John was just lying there? He was not responsible?
I didn't say he wasn't responsible. I just said he didn't kill her.
Well, no, wait a minute.
Keep thinking. Speaking of thinking, I was thinking the other day about how this friend of mine always concludes whatever she's saying with a proverb. When I asked why, she said because proverbs are the wisdom of the ages. If we followed the proverbs, we'd have happier lives. So I started putting together a list of proverbs. But every time I thought about one, I immediately thought of something that contradicted it.
All right, give me an example.
All right. You give me a word to live by, and I'll tell you what pops into my head. Go.
From Shakespeare. To thy own self be true.
When in Rome, do as Romans.
I see. Okay. A man's reach should exceed his grasp.
A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush.
Okay, let me try. Haste makes waste.
He who hesitates is lost.
It is never too late to learn.
You can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Good things come in small packages.
The bigger, the better.
Okay. There is no point in beating a dead horse.
If at first you don't succeed, try again.
He who hesitates is lost.
Act in haste, repent in leisure.
Two is company, three is a crowd.
The more, the merrier.
Nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Better safe than sorry.
Many hands make light work.
Too many cooks spoil the broth.
Never change horses in midstream.
Variety is the spice of life.
Silence is golden.
The squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Practice makes perfect.
All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
I see the problem.
So, what's the answer?
That's easy. It's like rationing. Apply one on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and the other on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Hmm. What about Sunday?
What about Sunday?
I have two choices. Which one applies on Sunday?
Well, just remember what my mother once said to me. She was waxing the floors and sent me out to play. She just got done and yelled for me to come in for lunch. I've been playing in the mud and ran right through into the middle of the floor and stood there. I remembered what she used to say about absence making the heart grow fonder, so I said, I missed you.
And what did she say?
Get out of here. And while I was outside, it came to me.
What?
Well, Mary was reading poetry, and she read something that made her hold her breath. And John threw a glass of water at her. But the glass slipped and broke. But it was too late, and Mary ran out of air and died.
Mary did run out of air, but why would John just lie down and take a nap?
Ran out of air. Let me think about that one some more.
Did you know my Aunt Polly was also a detective? When they had cases that stumped the police, they called in Aunt Polly. Recently, there was a rash of murders where the victim was found in the bathtub.
Well, that's not so unusual. Lots of people die in bathtubs.
True, but in these cases, the bathtubs weren't filled with water. They were filled with milk and cornflakes.
What did Polly decide?
She decided that they were on the trail of a serial killer.
Oh, jeez. Speaking of cereal, did you know how the Kellogg's Company got started? Kellogg's didn't start out with Tony the Tiger. It started with a man raised in a Seventh-day Adventist church and firmly believing in the principle of good health and good nutrition. John Harvey Kellogg was helped by church members to go to medical school, and upon graduation, he returned to his hometown to become a staff physician and eventually the superintendent of the Battle Creek Sanitarium, later to be called the Kellogg Sanitarium. He refused a salary and lived off the royalties his writings developed. The sanitarium, or rejuvenation clinic, became a hotel, hospital, spa, all in one for the wealthy clientele of health seekers.
Some of his ideas were way ahead of their time. For instance, he saw a connection between smoking and cancer. He believed in the benefits of a healthy diet, fresh air, exercise, and rest. He also had some extreme ideas like the benefits of excessive chewing and frequent cleansing of the bowels and opposing any sexual activity.
Now, my mother was into that. I can remember as a kid sitting at the dinner table and having to chew every mouthful 20 times before we could swallow.
You know, Bob, that didn't turn out to be such a bad idea. They've found that you eat less if you eat slower. It takes a while for your body to tell you it's full. If you eat fast, you've got way more than you need before the flag goes up.
I know that now, but when you're a hungry kid, 20 chews on mashed potatoes seems a bit much.
Anyway, he also had some pretty strange methods, including treatments with cold water and electric shock and mechanical manipulations, and he seemed to have an obsession with the bowels. He believed that 90% of all illness could be traced to unclean bowels, and he preached a regimen of colon cleaning that, for a while, became a national obsession.
But his greatest contribution came in nutrition. Would you believe that in his day, there was no cold breakfast cereals? Until he invented granola in 1881. Actually, he stole the idea from someone else who called it granula, with a U. When sued, he changed a few ingredients and changed the U to an O, and granola was born. Within a decade, he was selling 2 tons of the stuff a week, and the sanitarium was booming. By 1888, he had expanded to include a medical college, and a sanitarium could handle up to 700 patients at a time.
A change in the whole system came when Dr. Kellogg gave his younger brother, William, a job as an accountant. The brothers did not see eye to eye on several issues. The biggest was marketing. Because of John's success, competition had sprung up to cash in on the new breakfast fad. John was content the way things were. William was especially upset when a new cornflake hit the market. Forget it. It still wasn't Tony. John wanted to call it Sanitas. William could see where the name would go in the marketplace. John took a business trip, and while he was gone, William added sweeteners to the cornflakes. Before you knew it, William was managing the Battle Creek Toasted Cornflake Company, founded in 1906, selling Kellogg's Toasted Cornflakes under his own name.
The brothers didn't get along too well after that. William went on to great success. The cereal still bears his name, while John went back to his sanitarium. Unfortunately, once the Depression hit, the sanitarium business faded into nothing.
But eventually, there was more sugar and Tony.
John Kellogg would have turned over in his grave.
Did you know that some of his ideas carried over to other companies?
Really? Which ones?
Well, specifically, I had an uncle.
Oh, you too? I wonder if he was related to my uncle.
I'm sure he was. He was a second cousin twice removed from a third grandfather who had married his widowed second wife's third cousin by a previous marriage to a monkey's uncle. That's where your family comes in.
Wow! We're family.
You asked for it, Kurt.
I'll send you an invitation to the next family reunion.
You do that, Bob. Meanwhile, about your uncle, Kurt?
Right. He was an accountant for a major tea company. While he was there, they made a corporate decision that banned anyone in the accounting department from drinking.
Well, you shouldn't be drinking on the job.
No, Not just on the job. Anywhere, anytime. They were not allowed to drink at all.
Really? What was the rationale for that?
The company believed that if you were going to work for a tea company and be an accountant, you had better be a teetotaler.
Bob, be sure you send him 2 invitations.
Hey, since we're talking about food things, you know that proper measurement is important in cooking? You got to keep pints and quarts and teaspoons and tablespoons and that like all correct. What if Joel Lane had gotten quarts and ounces of brandy mixed up in the cherry bounce?
Raleigh might not be the state capital.
Right. Uh-huh. Which means Raleigh wouldn't even be here. It would still be just vacant ground. TRS wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here.
Don't get carried away, Bob. He got the recipe right. We are here. So go on about the measurements.
What measurements? No, not in the corner again. I remember. I was thinking how much better a lot of life would be if we had better measurements, like in politics.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I'll let my new big brother, cousin, grandfather, whatever you are, start. Go ahead, Kurt.
Oh, brother.
Hey, works for me.
All right. Okay, political measures. Two nincompoops equal one fathead. Two fatheads equal one incompetent. Three incompetents equal one opportunist. And two opportunists equal one Machiavelli.
Good job, brother. On a linear scale, two hops equal a skip. Two skips equal one jump. 24 jumps equal one stone's throw. Three stone's throw equals one piece. And 12 pieces equals one way in the heck gone.
Okay, I'll play. Two wrongs do not make a right, but three sometimes do. If three is too many, four may not be enough. Why is six afraid of seven? Because 7, 8, 9.
I got more for you there. Six ran away because seven came after him.
Would inflation make someone forgetful? If someone knew all about duck feathers, would he be Eiderweiss?
Pam, what does that measure?
It's a secret. I'll whisper it to you.
Oh, my God, you're right. Did you know I came across some new words and phrases that have strange origins?
Hey, I'm all for strange.
Now, that's a true story. Go ahead, Kurt.
Okay, how about potluck?
That's our family reunions where everybody brings something to share.
Actually, it's from the Middle Ages. Cooks would keep a pot of boiling water, and any scrap of leftover food would be thrown into the pot. The family would eat what was ever in the pot, or it could be served to strangers. The quality of the stew was up to luck.
How about slush fund? Slush was the name given to a galley grease on old sailing ships. Some of the grease was used to lubricate the masts. The rest was sold when the ship entered port. The proceeds from the slush was used to buy items for the enlisted men.
Haywire. I like that word. Anyway, when hay was baled, it was tight. If a wire snapped, it could whip around and hurt someone. It went haywire.
Broke. This one is interesting. Many banks in post-Renaissance Europe issued small porcelain tiles called borrower's tiles to their best customers. The person could then present the tile at the bank and receive an instant loan. If he had used up all of his allotted credit, then the banker immediately broke the tile in front of him.
Banks. In the early 19th century, English noblemen kept elaborate stables, which was an expensive luxury. When times got bad and money was not so plentiful, they saved money by reducing servants, which meant the stablemen didn't have the time to spend on individual horses. So they saved time and effort by giving all the horses' tails a standard cut, which was called banging off. Eventually, the look became popular with women's hairstyles.
And how about bomb? It was long used as a term involving explosives, but in the 1920s, a theater critic for the New York Standard wrote a bad review for a play wherein he said that the people were so anxious to leave the theater that a smoke bomb would have been quicker and less painful. His column was so popular that he started a feature where he gave a bomb notice to the worst play of the year.
Okay, how about husband and wife?
I suppose that's just a man and a woman got married.
Oh, not originally. Husband came from two German words which meant house owner. It had nothing to do with his marital status, except to indicate that would make him a desirable marriage prospect.
And wife came from two Anglo-Saxon words meaning weaver human. They originally had no words describing male and female, so they used the word wifmon to denote weaver human, a task usually performed by women.
And too many irons in the fire? From the blacksmith's forge. If the blacksmith had too many irons heating at once, he couldn't finish a job before one of them started cooling off, and so the project was unworkable.
Okay, the naked truth. The phrase comes from an old fable. Truth and falsehood went swimming together. Falsehood stole the clothes that truth had left on the bank. But truth refused to wear falsehood's clothes, and so left naked.
To give someone the cold shoulder, it refers to food. In England, a welcome guest would be served a hot meal, but an unwelcomed guest, or someone who had outstayed his welcome, would be given a cold shoulder of mutton.
About read someone the Riot Act. There actually was such a law as the Riot Act. Passed by Parliament in 1714, it made unlawful for a dozen or more people to gather for riotous or unlawful purposes. An authority would actually stand up and read the terms of the act so the people knew exactly what law they were breaking. It went, quote, "Our sovereign lord, the king, chargeth and commandeth all persons assembled immediately to disperse themselves and peacefully to depart to their habitations or to their lawful businesses," end quote. They didn't. They were arrested.
Okay, tied to her apron strings. Hundreds of years ago in England, if a man married a woman with property, he didn't have title to it, but could use it as long as she was alive. It was called apron string tenure. A man in that situation was in no position to argue.
Bitter pill to swallow, a medical term. The bark of the cinchona tree was extremely effective in fighting malaria, but the quinine it contained was very bitter. You had to take it to save your life, but it didn't make it taste any better.
And pass the buck. It was a gambling term. In the Old West, during certain card games, a buck knife was passed around the table and placed in front of whomever was responsible to deal the next hand. That person was also responsible to make sure that every person's ante was in the pot before the hand started. When it was no longer his responsibility, he passed the buck. And one last one. Did you know that the old Anglo-Saxon word for salt works was witch? W-I-C-H. Therefore, if ever you saw a town named Norwich or Greenwich, it meant that that town used to be an old salt works.
Did you know I have a final quiz for Pam?
What kind of a quiz is it?
Something that might help you solve the John and Mary story.
I was so close.
Yes, you are. Question one. How do you put a giraffe in a refrigerator?
Why would you want to?
It's a secret government project. Just answer.
Well, I guess you'd have to get a really big refrigerator.
Or a really small giraffe.
Maybe you take the refrigerator and pull out the insides and then slide it over the top of the giraffe.
The correct answer is you open the refrigerator door, put in the giraffe, and then close the door. This question tests whether you tend to do simple things in an overly complicated way.
Okay, next.
How do you put an elephant in the refrigerator?
Oh, got it. You open the door and put in the elephant and close the door. Simplest way.
Except you already have the giraffe in there.
Good thinking. You open the door, take the giraffe out, put in the elephant, and then close the door. This question tests your ability to think through the repercussions of your previous actions.
Well, what if I've got a really big refrigerator?
I think there's a law against storing a giraffe and an elephant in the same refrigerator. Giraffes don't like peanut butter.
I didn't think about that. Wait a minute. They don't want...
No. Okay. Moving right along. The Lion King is hosting an animal conference. All the animals attend except one. Who doesn't attend?
The termite.
Why the termites?
Oh, I don't know. Why not? I know I don't want a termite around.
All right. The answer is the elephant. He's in the refrigerator. You just put him there. This question tests your memory.
And I just bought a new memory card.
Take it back and tell him it doesn't work.
Okay, finally. There's a river you must cross, but this river is used by crocodiles and you don't have a boat. How do you get across the river?
Got it. You jump in and swim across.
Well, what about the crocodiles?
All the crocodiles are at the animal meeting. This tests whether you learn quickly from your mistakes.
Did you know I learned something else about the refrigerator?
I'm afraid to ask. Okay, what?
Well, when I opened the door to take the elephant out, a rabbit jumped in.
What did he do that for?
Well, that's what I asked the rabbit.
And what did he say?
He said, "I'm westing."
Westing?
Yep, that's what he said. And then he pointed at the refrigerator door, which said, "Westinghouse."
Anyway, did the test help you solve the problem?
Yes, it did. It all has to do with Jane Wyman.
What has she got to do with the animals?
Come on, guys, it's obvious. Jane Wyman used to be married to Ronald Reagan, right?
Okay, and so?
Well, who did Ronald Reagan star with? Bonzo. This is what happened. In 1941, Jane Wyman set the record for the longest film kiss, 3 minutes, 5 seconds, with Regis Tommy in a film called You're in the Army Now. John and Mary were trying to duplicate, or ape, the length of that kiss. That's where Bonzo comes in. Well, they suffered a lack of oxygen and they passed out. You said John was responsible, didn't kill her. So, when John just passes out, he flops down on the couch. But Mary staggers back and bashes her head into the mantel where there's a fishbowl full of water, but no goldfish, or they would have found one on the floor along with the broken glass in the water. That's where the hole in King Tut's head comes in. And the fishbowl has been sitting on the mantel right in front of the picture of the barn.
What barn?
The barn that the horse used to be in. That solves a problem.
Bob, you're amazing.
For someone that is so wrong, you come remarkably close to being right.
Am I close to being right? Or am I right because I'm close? And would I have been righter or closer if I'd closed the barn door? Or what if I'd taken the cow after it got out of the barn and put him in the refrigerator after I took the cow out, of course?
Bob.
Okay, then what's your answer?
Let me catch my breath after that reconstruction.
I have a better idea. This is Kurt Benroot for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
This is Pam Vesper.
If you would like to help underwrite some of our special programming, please call us at 832-5138.
That's 919-832-5138.
Wait a minute. I'll hold my breath and turn blue.
Are you going to do that before or after you kiss Bonzo for 3 minutes and 5 seconds?
We'd better tell him. I think he means it.
Okay, all right. It all happened at one of your family reunions.
Gee.
When Mary was in the punch bowl.
What was she doing in the punch bowl?
The backstroke, I think. When John put the horse back in the barn, ran over and jumped out of the cake that King Tut had found in the tomb.
Kurt, don't tell him that. Remember what happened when... Oh, better let me whisper it to you.
Right. Bob, this is what happened. John is a cat.
And Mary is a goldfish. The cat was playing with a fishbowl and knocked it over. End of story.
And the horse didn't get out of the barn?
No horse.
No barn.
What about King Tut?
He wasn't in the barn either.
And Jane Wyman?
She never kissed King Tut.
Oh. Are you still coming to the family reunion?
I'm taking care of the horse.
And it can't leave the barn.
This is Bob Martin. I think I'll go have a rest.
Goodbye.
Did you know airs Thursday nights at 9 p.m., Saturdays at noon, and Sunday evenings at 8? We would like to thank WRAL.com, a part of the Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting Company's New Media Group, for their continued support.